Hi, you're listening to Chefs on the Grill from Chicago Magazine.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Hey there, I'm Mike Nagrin, and welcome back to another edition of Chefs on the Grill. Chefs on the Grill is a collaboration between Chicago Magazine and Hungry Magazine, and you can find an archive of all of our interviews at www.chicagomag.com or www.hungrymag.com. This month I sit down with Greg Hall, the head brewmaster at Goose Island Brewery here in Chicago. Founded in 1988, Goose Island's been making craft brewed beers ranging from a lighter honker's ale and English-style bitter beer to super hoppy, smaller batch reserve-style beers such as their Imperial IPA. Goose and Greg Hall always have something up their sleeve, including a superior Belgian ale like Père Jacques, barrel-aged Bourbon County Stout, and their Imperial Brown Goose, a blend of Goose Island Christmas ales also aged in bourbon barrels, which are built to age like a fine wine. In this interview, there are a few terms that might not be familiar to all of our listeners. Throughout, Hall occasionally refers to AB, which stands for Anheuser-Busch. Also, we talk a bit about hops, which are aromatic flowers used primarily as a flavoring and stability agent in beer. They impart a floral or citrus component, as well as a bit of bitterness, which balances out the sweet syrupy flavor of malt in a final blend of beer. We also talk a bit about Orval and Rochefort, which are famous Belgian Trappist abbeys and breweries. Finally, we also talk a bit about Brettanomyces, or Brett, which is a wild yeast strain that's hard to control, but if properly managed, it imparts really interesting complex character to some beers. It serves as a backbone in many Belgian ales, including Goose Island's Matilda. Enjoy the interview.
You know, the first thing I think I'm interested in is sort of your first conscious beer memory. I think I had read that you were in the habit of taking Strohs from your dad, but I wondered if that was the first conscious beer memory or there was something else.
Well, I mean, the first conscious beer memory was certainly going to the beer store with my father when I was a young man and young boy, actually, and just kind of seeing there are all these, you know, you go to the grocery store with your mom and it's not nearly as exciting as going to the beer store with your dad. There's all these different beers and the bottles are different shapes and they're from all these different countries, and I just thought it was really cool. It was more fun, and I would always ask him, why don't you get this one? He's like, oh, no, that's no good. So, and I just remember particularly the Merchant of Vin display at the end of the aisle at the Safeway and on York Road in Hinsdale. That's where I really was like struck by some beers are fancier than others. And then, you know, as far as growing up goes, you know, everybody dabbles before they're, you know, allowed to dabble in beer. And usually you'd go to the nearest source, which is your refrigerator or garage. And my father did he was a Stroh guy when it came to local stuff, but he always had different stuff in the fridge. So, you know, I'd get an Anchor Steam or a Hanniger beer from Germany or a Hocker Shore or a Bass or a Guinness or just something. And, it, you know, I didn't care so much. It's just like, let's see, he's got more of these than anything else. I'll take that so he won't notice it. You know, and you come home and you're like, hey, there's a little goat on here with Celebrator. What's that? And you drink and you're like, whoa. And then you go over to your buddy's house and you go to his dad's garage. It's like, your dad's a wimp. You know, I can kind of chug this stuff, you know? If you're supposed to be a challenge when you're a young adult.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah.
You can measure the manhood by the taste of the beer.
I think that's, you know, I think unfortunately that's what our society's kind of put on it, you know, because it's such a taboo thing until you're 21. And I think that's why, sometimes that's why you have more problems in the U.S. than you do in other countries where it's not so taboo, where, you know, the drinking age is a little bit lower and you know, in a family environment, people drink beer. You know, they don't drink pitchers and pitchers of beer, but they can taste a beer. You know, like some people will, like, let their kids taste a little wine or something. Mm-hmm. It's more about acquiring the taste and knowing about that.
Yeah, I wondered about that. You have two kids, right?
Yes.
And I don't know how old they are, but I wonder what your thoughts on, you know, is there an age? Is there an appropriate? Where do you?
Well, you know, they're 5 and 7. They've both, you know, when they were old enough to stick fingers in my glass and suck the liquid off it, they were doing that. And, you know, there were beers that they wanted to stick their finger in more than once and beers that they got enough of that first time. So, I mean, it's a flavor thing. You know, little kids like sweetness, so they like sweet beers.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, they don't like bitterness, but my son liked bitterness.
Yeah.
And
so he's an Imperial IPA fan.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's a little hophead. You know, they don't drink beer at home or anything like that, but you know, they know the difference between just on site between beer styles, and they know the ingredients of beer, and they knew that before. Probably better than a lot of bartenders in town do.
You know, that's a good point. I think one of the things I think about doing interviewing a lot of chefs, you know, like Grant Atkins and Rick Tremonto and all these big guys, and you know, they make a lot about this idea that they think out of the box and that they're looking for different ways. But I mean, if you're really honest with yourself and you look at their beer lists and you look at what they're offering to consumers, you know, wine casts a pretty big shadow still.
And it's funny that way, because you know, We're in Chicago. We're in the middle of the country. We're in the beer belly of the country, and we have a higher percentage of beer drinkers here than other parts of the country. Yet you go out to, you know, Cocktail City, New York, and every decent restaurant's got a glorious beer list. You know, they had a great draft beer list at Gramercy Tavern 10 years ago. And then you go out to the West Coast, too, and craft beer is enormous. So I think it's something that's starting to catch on, and it's great to see it starting to catch on, and it's great to see certain people that have been proponents of it. Lettuce actually has had pretty good beer for a long time. The Blackbird folks, between Blackbird and Avec, they don't have a real deep beer list, but the beers they have are all really good.
And he's planning a new gastropub, so I'm guessing.
Right. Right.
Gonna be
right. Although
good.
I don't think they're calling it a gastropub
right,
anymore.
Right, because nobody knows what a gastropub is in America.
Yeah. Yes. And the ones that I think are calling themselves gastropubs now leave a little to be desired.
True.
The thing is, we already have a lot of gastropubs in Chicago. They just don't identify themselves that way. I mean, certainly Hopleaf is top of the heap for anywhere. I mean, there's not a better Belgian beer list in many places in Belgium, you know, and I've been all over Belgium, and, you know, they've got a pretty deep beer list there, and they've got great food, and they don't have, you know, burgers and nachos. They're trying to do fun stuff. Hot Chocolate has a good beer list and good beer food, and I think, you know, people sometimes don't really look at it. Naha has got a good beer list, you know. If they had a little more dark wood in there, would it be a gastropub? You know, I don't know what the difference is.
Yeah, it's terminology.
As
long as you got good beer and good food, that's all that matters. Okay?
Absolutely.
I wondered about, you know, I've interviewed some local brewers, and you hear about all these like early days, like of the wine cellar, and you know, back in like 88 to 94, kind of like this golden age of the birth of the microbrewery and the brew pubs. And you know, I wonder what it was like around here at Goose Island back in those early days, and you know, if there's some interesting stories or things you remember.
You know what, back in the early days, back in, you know, 88 through like 93, we were, I think, viewed as an absolute oasis, because there was not a lot of availability of good beer in Chicago. There was a ton of beer, but you know, you'd go to a place and you could get beer from St. Louis, Milwaukee, or La Crosse, and that was about it. You know, and they'd have 9 beers on tap, and they'd kind of look and smell and taste alike.
I had read that your friends, when you were getting into this business, had thought that you might be a tavern owner, you know, if you hadn't gone into this brewing. I wondered if there was a sense of you ever rebelling even against the idea of doing this, you know, was there something else you really wanted to do otherwise?
You know what, I tell you, the best thing about being in the beer business, even better than drinking for free, is everybody else that's in the beer business. Uh-huh. You know, it's a great business to be in. And, you know, I'm going over to Belgium next week, and I'm going to go visit friends there. And, you know, any part of the country you go to, the other brewers open their arms up to you, you know, and I've got a picture of me outside a brewery in England, which is the only brewery that wouldn't let me in that I've ever been to. You know, that's the great thing about this business, is there's just so many great people in it. And I couldn't imagine another business, you know, that's like that. It's not, craft brewers right now, I think, generally don't see each other as competition, because we're all growing you know, all boats rise with the tide kind of thing. We're all growing so well. There's so much opportunity to get more good beer in people's hands. Why would I fight with Boulevard or Summit or Larry Bell over a drinker, you know, when there's 10 other guys in the beer drinking an import? You know, we should be trying to get him to drink the beer rather than fighting over the one craft beer drinker. So it's really, you know, that's what I think the appeal to me in the tavern thing is. You go to a tavern, everybody's having fun. You know, who doesn't want to have a fun job?
Sure.
And then you get into the beer business and you're just kind of even deeper into that.
Which it brings up the idea, I know, you know, obviously right now the hot topic is distribution, and New Glarus hasn't been in the market for a few years, and Bell's is now gone, and what is, you know, there's obviously, as you said, you know, there's not a lot of competition, you guys tend to be more friends, and you're trying to encourage good beer, and it seems to me that by having those two out of the market, you have this, you know, it impacts the beer culture more than anything, and it's
bad for the Chicago beer drinker, and anything that's bad for the Chicago beer drinker, I think, is bad for the Chicago brewer. You know, I wish there were more brew pubs in Chicago. I wish there were more strong local craft brands in Chicago. You look at the markets that do really, really well with craft, there isn't just one king of the hill. You know, there's a million good craft beers. You know, certainly you go out to the West Coast, you go out to Portland or Seattle, there are more craft brewers in Portland. There's probably 12 craft brewers in Oregon and Washington, Alaska, that are almost twice as big as Goose Island. And you put all those states together, and they got half our population. I think that it's a bad thing when brewers leave our market. One thing I will tell you, though, is both of those brewers made the choice to leave the market. Nobody got kicked out of Chicago. We left Seattle and Portland. We went out there in 2005, and we were out there for a year, and we just said, you know what, this is crazy, freight's crazy, and we pulled out. We didn't get the big story in the newspaper, unfortunately, like some of the other guys did in Chicago. But they made the choice to leave. No one made them leave. So it's hard doing business here, absolutely. You know, we know that firsthand better than anybody. Very, very competitive, and not competitive with other crafts, just with everybody. Sure. You know, you walk into a bar, they've got 8 tap handles, there's 40 beers that want that handle, not just craft, but everybody. So that's where it's competitive. There's a lot of opportunity because it's a big market, but I think that you'll see both those brands come back sometime. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll be good for us and good for everybody. Brooklyn just came into Chicago. Mm-hmm. Chicago's ran something on that today.
Yeah, I just read that.
Yeah, and that's great. You know, Garrett Oliver's a friend of mine. He'll come in, he'll do some beer dinners. That'll get more people drinking good beer. That's mm-hmm. great for beer.
You said in the recent Chicago Reader article about the Bell's distribution that you guys are in the beer-making business, not the beer delivery business.
Absolutely.
One of the reasons, ostensibly, that, you know, Bell's pulled out, you know, I don't know what the politics of the situation were, but at least on the surface, one of the reasons you talk about is this idea of how their beers would be handled in the market.
And that's what a lot of the talk was, and I can't speak for either, you know, the Bell side or the distribution side, so I don't know exactly how they were going to be handled. Mm-hmm. I certainly wasn't in on that. You know, we basically went and we made the best deal for us, because what we had in our market was, we had people saying, how do I get your beer? I'm sick of having to drive to the brewery to get your beer. Mm-hmm. You know, I like your IPA, and I go to a store and I can get your Honker's Ale, but I can't get your IPA. Mm-hmm. You know, what's it going to take to do that? And what it took was us changing distributors.
And your distribution is with Widmer, which there's much that's been made about this. They are, you know, minority owned by Anheuser-Busch, and I wondered if you thought you were unfairly put upon, or if there's been too much hubbub about that.
You know
that.
What, and I'll tell you this. When Red Hook and Widmer, especially when Red Hook went that route, and they signed a distribution agreement with Anheuser-Busch, and Anheuser-Busch took a minority stake in Red Hook, that was they got so much crap from the beer business, the craft beer business. It was unbelievable. But that was back in the mid-90s when all of us guys were making like 2,000 barrels a year, and you know, thinking that the sky was the limit. We weren't running. No one was running into distribution problems yet. You know, the only guys who might have been are like Pete's, which had tons of problems, and Sam Adams and Sierra. They're the only other ones big enough to have any distribution problems yet. Now, you know, when we signed this thing, we got a lot of crap from certain people, but not nearly as much as the other guys did, and I got almost zero from brewers. You know, they're all like, good for you, you know, and the way I see it is whether it's Goose Island in a Bud House or Red Hook or Widmer or Kona or some other new brewery in a Bud House, if that's getting more craft beer distribution to more parts of the country, then there's going to be more craft beer drinkers. You know, there's more people drinking good beer. You know, where's the bad part of that? You know,
I wondered if the distinction was important to you, that it was Widmer, you know, and that it wasn't, because they are still a craft brewer and they understand.
Right.
Yeah, I wondered if that was a part of the equation and why you guys.
Yeah, well, you know, they're the one, they took a, we did a little side deal with them as far as the equity thing goes. That was pretty public. But, you know, I don't think it mattered that much to us. I mean, it worked out that way for us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with all the publicity we got with the distribution stuff, you know, nobody really even paid attention to the Widmer stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, speaking on the distribution thing, the other thing is the freshness thing. And when you're a big wholesaler like AB, and when the brewery has demands on the wholesaler that they must rotate the beer, they must keep the beer fresh. If you look at the date codes of every brewery out there in the industry, Anheuser-Busch's are the shortest. Mm-hmm. Does that mean their beer gets old quicker? No. It means they have the ability to control their distribution system so they can get fresher beer out quicker. Everybody, there's not a brewer out there that wouldn't want to have a distributor that could do 110-day turnaround on their beer. That's the best thing you could ever imagine. Mm-hmm. Especially when you start out in the brew pub business and basically you've got an hour turnaround on your beer.
Right.
You know, you filter it and you're pouring it right away. But that's what I was used to. And that's kind of the tough thing about when you get in distribution, you put your beer in a bottle and you got to say goodbye. It's like your kid's going off to college, you know. You prepared him for it, but what's going to happen next? It's, you know, you don't control it anymore. So, with AB, you kind of do control it. They've been rotating our beer. They actually have standards of what we can ship them. We can't ship them beer that's a month old. Mm-hmm. That's too old. Whereas, you know, you'd go to, you know, other markets and you'd find beer that was fresher than you'd have in Chicago, just because, you know, a liquor house doesn't really rotate liquor. Mm-hmm. You know, they put that, sell that 10 cases of Absolut in, you know, they don't have to move it around. No
sure.
one's looking at date codes on vodka.
Sure.
But beer distributors, they're used to it. And AB does a better job than anybody.
How many barrels do you guys brew a year now?
I think we did 73,000 last year. Mm-hmm. And we can pretty comfortably get to 100 with everything we've got right now. So our target's a little lower than that this year, but we can get up to about 100, which would be great. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we just came out of a meeting. We were talking about, you know, some of our options for adding capacity for next year if we need to.
Mm-hmm. I have a friend who used to work here, John Mangy.
Sure.
He went to Lagunitas.
Yeah.
He, you know, he always used to tell these stories about how, you know, the thing that you guys really excel at is the quality control and you know, how it's, you know, because I think people think about it and they're like, oh, they're a craft brewery. It's like this mom and pop thing. But you guys are very stringent on your quality and how you measure, you know, whether, I don't know whether it's pH or whatever it is in terms of getting at, you know, the right craft of the brew. And, you know, I wondered about, you know, that side of things and like, you know, I know Anheuser-Busch has released an organic beer this mm-hmm. the last couple of years. And one of the things I've been really surprised about the craft industry, because when you think about craft or you think about artisanal, you think, oh, well, they're using all these great ingredients and everything, and but then you go and you visit some of these places, and you know they're using pelletized hops, and I understand that there's a place for all those things, and I understand that dry hops give you something different than fresh hops. I know, I think you guys use fresh hops in the IPA, right?
And then we actually use pelletized hops in everything, and that's basically, you know, the best way to illustrate that is, you know, there's really three kinds of hop products. There's baled hops, where they take fresh hops, they dry them, and they press them in big bales, and it kind of resembles dried herbs, you know, of one sort or another. And that's kind of the least amount of processing. But the tough thing is, if you're making beer commercially, you're generally doing it 12 months a year, and you're getting your hops in the early fall, and then you don't get them again. So, you know, right now you'd be using like 3-month-old hops, and come the summer using 9-10-month-old hops. They don't store it real great that way. When they pelletize them, they take the hops, they don't dry them, they grind them up into powder, and then they put them through a press, and then they vacuum pack them. So you don't really, while you're processing them more by grinding them up and pelletizing them, you're actually, they're maybe not quite as fresh that first month, but the other 11 months, they're going to be fresher than baled hops. And even AB, who had always used bale hops, went to pellets recently. I don't know if that's public or not. But but you know what? The thing is, you go to a brewery that has a hop room, and there's a couple big ones out in California, that probably the two biggest craft brewers in California. Go out there, and you go in their hop room, and it smells great, because this wonderful aroma of hops. Go in our hop room, it doesn't smell like anything because all the aroma is still in the box, in the hops, so it can go in the beer. Because if it's on the guy, you know, the 30 people walking in, taking the tour, and they smell like hops, that's not going to go into the beer, mm-hmm. You know. And as far as organics go, we were one of the first breweries in the country to be organically certified, and we still make all the beer for Whole Foods.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, their brand, which is called Lamar Street, we've been making that for a long time, and still make all their the Lamar Street beer, which is organic. The funny thing, though, is organic hops, and to be called organic, the rules of being organic typically are it's got to be 95% organic by weight. So in a beer, no one uses 5% by weight hops. That would be 10 times hoppier than the hoppiest Imperial IPA. It just doesn't make sense. So you could always get away with using all organic malt and then not using organic hops. So there, no one's growing organic hops. Well, now you've got AB making two organic beers that are I believe, using organic hops. There's no organic hops left. Mm-hmm. So it's not just like, you know, hey, we need more organic hops, grow some more organic hops. I mean, you know, you're 3 years out for more organic hops. That's what it's going to. I think that's 2008. It's going to be either sometime this year or next year, it's got to be 100% organic to be organic.
Yeah. I had read, too, about how Sierra Nevada, like, they had the coordinates of, like, when things were getting cut in the field, it was in the place an hour later because you lose the essential oil.
Yeah, I think that's what they do with one of their beers. They actually use what they call wet hops, where they take hops that haven't been dried and they put them right in the beer right after harvest. I used to grow hops in my front yard, and I did a little home brewing with fresh hops, and it certainly smells great when you pull them off, but never did anything commercial with the hops we grew. You know, I think with the city spraying for mosquitoes and all that, I'm sure nobody wants that in their beer. But they certainly smell great.
Are there ingredients or things that you're really interested in using, or things that you've been thinking about? Obviously, you've done some of this barrel aging now.
We've been, you know, it's always been kind of my personal philosophy. We're very purist on things, and we basically stick to water, malt, hops, and yeast with our beer. You know, without really a whole lot of exceptions, a couple things that are, you know, where Bell's Nails call for some sugar, we'll do that. But other than that, we're pretty much water, malt, hops, and yeast. And, you know, I think back, we had a lot of we had a lot of pressure from distributors back in the 90s to make like a raspberry wheat beer because that's what everybody wanted. And, you know, we held fast and didn't make that. And I think everybody that was making raspberry wheat beers isn't really around anymore because that's not a real credible style.
So Blind and Coils or Barry Weiss.
Well, yeah, I guess there's still some. But, you know, we've tried to make some cool beers by using traditional methods, either by barrel aging, you know, which up until 100 years ago, pretty much every beer ever made in the history of Earth was barrel aged, because that's what you had to hold the beer in, was a barrel. Beer was kind of used to it, so that's kind of bringing something back. And the other thing we do a lot of at Goose Island is play around with funky yeast strains. And that's something that we kind of hang our hat on, is that we probably use more yeast strains than most commercial, if not all commercial brewers.
Yeah, I was drinking the Matilda last night, and, you know, I understand, doesn't the yeast strain come from the Orval brewery, or it's the similar?
Right, it's an Orval-type yeast for the primary fermentation. Then we use a Brettanomyces, which is kind of a cultivated wild yeast, for the secondary fermentation, and, you know, gets it pretty funky.
Yeah, a lot of people talk about Brettanomyces mm-hmm. being this sort of bad thing, you know, but I know people are embracing it more. I wondered, is it harder to control in the process? And
much, much harder. It's, you know, a typical cervases that a brewer would use is very predictable, you know, when you control the environment. And I think a lot of it just has to do with no one's really been making beers with Brett on this side of the country for a long, long time. And no one's ever really been doing it on purpose like we've been doing. There's a few small guys on the West Coast. Vinny at Russian River does a lot of cool stuff with Brett. And then guy Tommy Arthur at Pizza Port down in San Diego area, he's been doing stuff, but he's on a brew pub level. So I think we were one of the first, if not the first, to bottling beer with Brett, doing a full secondary fermentation in a tank with the Brett, and then letting it ferment down and then bottling it. So there's really no one to learn from on that. So we've kind of had to learn on the fly here, and we were lucky enough to get it right like the second or third time we tried it and brought it up to a larger batch size and been able to continue to do it our certain way, and it's worked real well for us.
Last night, also, I was drinking some Elijah Craig 18 bourbon, and, you know, I read that I think you guys use Jim Beam barrels for the barrel-aged,
mm-hmm.
and I wondered if, you know, the difference, I mean, like if you use like an 18-year-old, would that be better, or, you know?
We've actually done that. We started off using all Beam stuff, and because we had a contact at Beam. Actually, Booker No set us up with the first batch of barrels. We were always real happy with that, but then we said, hey, why don't we try something else? And the last batch of Bourbon County Stout, we had in Heaven Hill barrels. So they had 12 to 14-year-old spirit in them. And then we did our first blend, which was the Imperial Brown Goose that had some brown ale that had been aged in Beam and then some other that had been aged in the older Heaven Hill stuff, and really was probably more happy with that than anything, because that is really, to me, that's you're tasting what the barrel smells like. And everybody's tasted whiskey, and you know what whiskey tastes like, and you get some whiskey flavors in a lot of the bourbon barrel aged beers, but to really get the barrel itself, because you've got to be there like when you're filling the barrel to know what the barrel smells like. And it just smells fantastic. There's nothing else like it. You're not,
I know, you pull out that bung and it's just like, you know,
it's not just, you know, the spirit in there, but the wood itself and the vanillin that's in the wood, and boy, it smells great. And we just thought if we could make another beer that wasn't quite as big and overwhelming as the Imperial, as the Russian, what am I saying?
Bourbon,
the Bourbon County Stout. You know, where we took a really strong Russian stout and then put it in a barrel. There's just not a lot of room to take up flavor because there's already a lot of flavor in it to begin with. Similarly, we get some bourbon flavor and some barrel flavor. But going on a little bit lighter canvas, you get a lot more of that barrel flavor. And we've got a couple things up our sleeve that we're going to try this year. We've got some new barrels coming in. Got some more stuff to do in bourbon barrels and some stuff to do in actually some raw barrels, too.
And you guys are now doing the first aged beer or beer built for aging, is that right? The Imperial Brown, is that?
Well, we do. We actually, if you look at our reserve line, most of our reserve line, we put a 5-year date code on them. And I think if you're able, you have any Père Jacques from 2004, 2005, 2006, we'll be bottling the 2007 next year. And if you line them all up, they'll all taste different. And, you know, I think depending on the taster, you'll have a different favorite. Because in the beginning, you get a lot of that big banana character from the yeast. And then, you know, that starts to fade away. And then you get more of the caramel flavor coming out. And then when it gets to year 3 and year 4, you're starting to get all these kind of dried fruits coming out of it. So it's really changing. Evolving in the bottle, you know, just the way a nice wine would.
Mm-hmm. How do you structure? Is it like high alcohol content and high bitterness or hops? Is that what?
Well, the hops are really the thing that when a hop oxidizes, you get kind of that skunky, cardboardy flavor. So that's usually not seen to be really yummy. Then on the other side, when malt oxidizes, you're getting more of a raisiny, currant-y flavor, which, if that's in a American-style light lager, that's not going to be appropriate. But if it's in a beer that's already got chocolate and caramel and fruity flavors to begin with, that's just another level of complexity. So it's kind of like a tawny port. If you think of like a, you know, vintage port versus a tawny port, tawny port's already oxidized, and you got all these cool vanilla flavors and, you know, flavors that you're never really going to get in the vintage, and I think you see more of that happening with our beers. You get that same kind of reaction in a beer where the sweet flavors kind of develop a little bit differently than the hoppy flavors. So if you look at our reserve line beers, the Imperial IPA, we actually have the regular date code on there for 180 days. Because that's one that, after a year, we tried it, and it's like, we do not want this beer out there a long time. It's glorious when it's fresh, but when it's not, it tastes like you're munching into a pile of cardboard.
Yeah. I had read that you had said about, I don't know if it was a writer or somebody, but you had challenged them on this idea of, you know, now that you've gone into all these breweries and these Trappist places and you've kind of learned a lot of the techniques and you've tried to honor that tradition, you challenged somebody that, you know, we're making in the United States or even in Goose, you know, some of the best, maybe better Belgians than Belgians. And I think the ultimate result was you had a Rochefort up against, maybe it was the Père Jacques, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy had actually preferred the Père Jacques in a blind test, you know. So
you know, and that's the thing is that there's, you know, we'll always honor the tradition of the brewers who have come before us, and they've done a lot of cool stuff. And there's not, you know, they were the original ones. They were the ones doing big super malty beers, you know, before anybody else, really to sustain themselves. And then you had other brewers using all crazy different yeasts. You know, we're not original in that sense. We haven't been completely original other than kind of the bourbon barrel thing. But what we're doing is we're taking kind of some of the best of these old world style of beers and then just having a little bit more technical proficiency on this side, because maybe we've got a little bit newer, fancier equipment that, you know, enhances the quality of the beer once it's in the bottle for a longer period of time. And that's something that, you know, I think you've got a couple things going on. You look at the old world brewers, they'll always make their great old styles and their great beers. But in America, we're now kind of challenged And you've got all these great brewers that are making, you know, German-style Hefeweizens probably as good or better than they've ever made them in Germany, and English-style, you know, IPAs and pale ales and bitters. You know, it's great to, you go to the World Beer Championships in Seattle last year, and or the World Beer Cup, and, you know, Americans won most the titles, you know, no matter what the style was. You know, we won a silver medal with Matilda in the Belgian French ale category against Belgian and French ales. Mm-hmm. And it's judged by brewers from all over the world.
Yeah, I remember reading Michael Jackson said if he'd give a prize for best in show, he would have slapped it on the Matilda.
Yeah, we'll take that.
I know you do a lot of trips, and of course, some of those stories make it onto your reserve beer bottles, which I think is a really nice touch, and it gives you a better understanding. You know, it's nice to read something while you're drinking the bottle, or you shouldn't be drinking the bottle. You should be having
sure.
a proper glassware. But you have a bottle next door too.
Right.
You know, Greg Brown up at Mickey Finn's, I had talked to him last year, and he had told me a little bit about kind of the story of you guys going into the Père Jacques brewery and where that kind of came from. And I kind of wondered what your take was on it. It sounded like a real magical experience, and I know I'm sure most of it's on the bottle, but...
Oh, not even 1% of it's on the bottle. You know, that because there's the whole story of before we even got there, Rochefort was one place that... talking to people in Belgium, in the beer bars in Belgium, places like Beer Circus and Beer Temple, you know, you say, well, where should we go next? And they're like, well, you know, this place, that place. We're like, what about Rochefort? Ah, oh, you can't go to Rochefort. You know, they don't really have visitors. No one gets into Rochefort. So then, you know, when they say that, your ears perk up. And you're like, well, that's where we got to go. So my colleague in planning the beer trips back in the late 90s, spoke a little bit of French, so he was the guy that got on the phone, and he called up Rochefort, and I think it was on the seventh time he finally got someone to talk to him, and said, and say, yes, we'll do a tour, and talked to him, and was all excited, talking about the details, and the way he says it, at the end of the conversation, he's like, well, I just want to make sure this is going to be cool, and, you know, you don't need to get it approved, and because if we're going to put it on our itinerary, we want to make sure that we're actually going to be able to get there. And the guy on the other end of the phone said, I only work for two people, the Pope and God. I'm Père Jacques.
That's great.
Yeah. And then once we got there, the other cool, actually, another story before we got there, we were closing up the planning of it about a month out, just tying up any loose ends. And he called and he said, you know, Père Jacques on the other end said, I'm sorry I didn't ask this of you before, but do you have any women on your tour? And we did, we had two. And he's like, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this before, but we do not allow women into the Abbey, you know, and it's not my rule. This is a couple centuries old rule. There are no women visitors. So we're like, oh, great, because we've got people's money and, you know, they all think they're going to Rochefort, so... We're like, well, what can we do in there? He's like, well, you know, we can let them in. I can let them into kind of the receiving place up front, but I can't take them into the Abbey and into the brewery and into the church and all that. So we called up the two women that were going. They're like, you know, we're like, you know, we can basically, the options are we go there and you just kind of wait for us there, or we have a diversion trip where you can go somewhere else, or we just don't go. And they're like, oh, we don't want to screw it up for everybody else, so we'll just go, and we'll just wait. So we got there, we got to the Abbey, we knocked on the door, no answer. And it's not like a big entrance. You go to Chimay, it's a beautiful big entrance. You got Japanese maples, you know, on either side of this big cobblestone pathway up to the enormous door, main entrance of Chimay. Not so at Rochefort. They don't expect visitors. So there's just a little man door with a little hand-painted no visitors sign. So you knock on the door, nobody comes. Knock on the door. It's kind of drizzling. Everyone's standing outside the bus, kind of looking at me and my partner. And we're like, oh, this is not good. You know, knock. Finally, we hear a tap, tap, tap. Somebody's coming to the door. Guy opens the door. He's a monk. He's probably about 17, 18 years old. got the monk haircut, got the monk outfit on, straight out of Central Casting. And he's like, oh, no, no, no visitor, no visitor. And we're like, oh, no, no, we're from Chicago. We've got a, we talked to Père Jacques. He's like, no, no. And we're like, here, we got the facts from Père Jacques. He's like, oh, you're from Chicago. Come on in. So we went in. We sat down, big long table, twice as long as this, big oak table. They had beer on the table for us already. They had these ginger snap cookies, which were wonderful. And then Père Jacques comes in. And he's absolutely straight out of Central Casting. Anybody who's ever drank Père Jacques and pictured him got it right the first time. You know, he's probably about like 5'7". He's got the little grayish beard. You know, got the bald top. You know, short cropped hair, just exactly as you picture him. And he gave us the history of the Abbey, the history of the brewery, how Napoleon tried to burn it down twice. Both times it rained for like 2 days and put the fire out. And, you know, after doing like half an hour of drinking beer and talking, he said, okay, now it's time to tour the brewery. And we had the two women in there, and we're like, so should they stay here? Do you want them to go back out on the bus? And he's like, you know what? It's the year 2000. You know, new millennium, time to bring them in. So they're the first two women ever at the Rochford Abbey to sign the guest book.
Incredible.
So that was, I mean, we all got goosebumps, but they were just, you know, flabbergasted that they got to go in.
Weren't the cookies baked by like a local cloister of nuns or something like that too?
by the monks, I'm sure. Yeah, it was amazing. And then after, you know, going through the brewery and the abbey, and we actually saw the little rooms where they live and stuff, which is just a tiny little studio with a little like futon thing on the floor and like one little table and one little stool and like three hooks for their three brown robes, and that's about it. We're going to go to lunch, and we're like, would you please honor us and come to lunch with us? And he's like, yeah, I got time for lunch, you know, I'd love to. Where are you going? And we told him we were going, which was a place that had been recommended to us. And he's like, oh, no, 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 no. Give me a minute. So he went back in the office, came back out. He's like, you know, we'll go to my place for lunch. So we went to this place. He gave the bus driver directions, and we all went, and they had it all set up for us. They had, like, wild boar and, like, trout from the brook in the river and, you know, cheese, and it was just unbelievable. It was, like, just a feast. You know, and we were there for like 2 hours, 3 hours eating lunch. And then he bought us lunch. He wouldn't let us spend any money there.
Oh, wow.
So that was just, you know.
That's incredible.
That was just an incredible day. Incredible day that anybody who was there will never, ever forget. And I knew that we had to honor him with something, you know, a little bit more than just a thank you note. So we decided to go back and kind of reformulate our Belgian. We'd made a beer that we'd call Blue before, which was kind of after Chimay Blue. Big, malty, rich Belgian Abbey Ale. And we kind of reformulated it to be a little bit more like Rochefort and named it Père Jacques after him.
I should know this, but why are monks the guardian of good beer?
Well, as I understand it, you know, the tradition was they took the whole Lent thing pretty seriously, and they'd fast for 40 days and 40 nights, but they could drink, they just couldn't eat. So what they did is they made beers with as much malt as they could fit in there, and basically you've got all those carbs in there, and that's what kind of sustained them. And, you know, the more malt you put in, not only the more carbs you get, but the more fermentable sugar and the more alcohol you get, so maybe they probably spoke a little bit closer to God's ear at those 40 days and 40 nights too of drinking 9% beer all day. But that's certainly part of it. The other part is, you know, they were just totally self-sustaining, and because of that, the monasteries are kind of the first hotels. You know, there was no reason to have a hotel because nobody ever traveled unless you were like the king. Everybody just kind of lived where they lived, and when the pilgrims started like going down to on the Crusades, they needed a place to stay, and they'd stay at the monastery, and they needed some provisions to take with them, And they couldn't bring, you know, water or milk or apple juice because it'd go bad and they'd all die. So they'd have to bring something alcoholic. They brought beer.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, what a great thing.
Yeah.
Jonathan Cutler, I think, used to work here. He's at peace, and he's done very well for himself. You've had a lot of good guys come out of here, and they've kind of permeated the craft world. As we were just talking about John's over at Lagunitas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start to think of it like chefs and like sous chefs and how all these people used to work for Trotter and they went off and did these great things. And I wonder, are there some people at Goose now that you're working with who are real talents or like people that we should know about?
Sure. I mean, the thing is they all are, you know, and that's the thing. And that's the, you know, going back to John Mangi and kind of some of the first early guys that were here, we got really lucky early on that we hired some people that really got the culture and the passion. And, you know, when you talk about making good beer, it's really just like a kitchen. You know, you've got your ingredients, you've got your tools, you know, your stove and your pots and pans, and then you've got your chef. And, you know, it's pretty hard to argue that the chef's not the most important thing. You know, you can take Grant or Charlie and you put them in your kitchen, and he'll make a pretty good feast no matter, you know, what you've got in your pantry and and what kind of stovetop you've got. And we got some very passionate people early on, and it's kind of continued to trickle down. So the more people we bring in, they're taught, you know, by the people that have been here, and they were taught by Mangi and Matt Brennelson and Cutler and, you know, people that have kind of caught the passion and got caught up in it. You know, very few people have left here, only a couple really, because it didn't work out. You know, most people leave because they, you know, want to live in a different part of the country or there's an opportunity to run a brewery somewhere else. And, you know, we've got guys, we had a bunch of guys at Three Floyds for a while, that a lot of those guys have moved out west. We've got the guy that runs quality for Bell's. Matt Brennelson, who was our first head brewer here, is at Firestone Walker, and they won, when we won four medals at the World Beer Cup, they won five. So we kind of felt like it was, nine in the Goose Island family, mm-hmm. You know, when an ex-Goose guy wins. And then Cutler won a couple, too. So, you know, we take pride in that, you know, and we cheer them on. You know, we think that if we can teach people, you know, that the importance of looking at every little detail in the process and measuring everything and keeping track of everything so that you can reproduce it and make the beer, you know, at the very least the same, if not better, you know, over years, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And if they go on and teach that to other people and there's more good beer out there, you know, there's no chance that's going to hurt Goose Island. Mm-hmm. That's just going to make craft beer stronger, and it's going to make our position in craft beer stronger.
Did you homebrew before you started working here, or I'd
never homebrewed. And I've really only kind of partially homebrewed now because
that's like a busman's holiday for you.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we kind of got the brew pub now where we can do whatever we want. That's the nice thing about the brew pub situation. You know, if we would have probably started off as a bottling plant, then I probably would have become a really big home brewer. But, you know, in the brew pub, you say, boy, I feel like making a porter this week. Well, guess what? You make a porter and you write porter on the chalkboard and people buy it and, you know, you're all good.
Have there been some greatest hits, like some ones that you haven't made it to national or even regional distribution, but that you just love and they're like these sort of, you know, these great secrets that you guys had on tap?
There's been, you know, I'm a big fan of English bitter. So whenever Will Turner, our head brewer at the brew pub, has got some of the old school English bitters that we've done on tap, those are ones I definitely go over and drink a lot of. One we call Yorkshire bitter, one we call, let's see, John the Younger, awfully good. Because I'm, you know, as much as I'm proud of the really big beers, the Belgians and the Bourbon County Stout and stuff like that, I'm more of a beer drinker. You know, I'd rather have a, you know, five Honkers Ales than one Bourbon County Stout, because, you know, it's just a little more social experience. And probably some of my best memories of drinking beer are not just in Belgium, but over in England, going to the pubs, you know, where you can sit there and drink beer for 6 hours, and there's no TV and no music. You know, it's just, you got to entertain yourself by talking to somebody, you know, kind of a lost art.
Which kind of leads to my last question, which is, you know, beer is all about gathering with friends and family and having a good time sometimes, and maybe it should be all the time. And I wondered, you know, if you put together, like, the round table for one last, you know, hurrah with some good goose. You know, it doesn't have to be people who are alive, too, people who are dead. Who would you want to talk to? People you maybe haven't...
I think that I would rather have it... I would not have it with, you know, world leaders of the past. I would have it with some of my buddies and people I know, because there's nothing better than sitting around a table telling stories about things we've done together. Some of our other hijinks, travels. That's more fun than anything else.
Yeah.
So that's what I would do. I'd get, I can think, and it's, nobody, most people would know, but I can think about five or six guys, get around a table, and we just drink beer and talk about drinking beer in the past and how much fun it's been.
Cool. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening. As always, if you have any feedback, please email me at mjnagran@hungrymag.com. See you next month, and in the meantime, stay hungry.